It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's legislature is in the midst of a floor session debating bills, working to advance proposals through committees.
Lawmakers have introduced hundreds of proposals, many of which may never see the light of day. Both parties have introduced legislation related to education, elections, and governance.
Last week, we talked to Speaker Robin Voss, leader of the Republican majority in the Assembly. Now we welcome Representative Greta Neubauer, the Democratic minority leader. She represents a Racine area district. Representative Neubauer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to legislation, Representative Neubauer, I want to talk about concerns about political violence in the country, recent high-profile incidents, Utah, Minnesota, and elsewhere. Do you and your colleagues think about this? Is this on your radar as you go about your job?
We do. After the assassinations of Representative Melissa Hortman in Michigan and Charlie Kirk,
Minnesota.
Both devastating... Oh, I apologize. Yeah, acts of political violence. This is something that members of our caucus, staff, people visiting the Capitol are thinking about. We are continuing to have conversations to ensure that everyone has appropriate safety measures in place. But this is a really difficult political environment, and it will have real impacts on our ability to do our work moving forward.
Speaker Voss said, hey, in effect, we don't want to turn the Capitol into a fortress. But he did float the idea of saying lawmakers could use their office budgets in part for home security. Is that something you think could be a useful step? Is it enough?
I do think that would be appropriate, particularly after Melissa Hortman and her husband were killed in their home. It's a first step, but we do know that there are questions that remain about public events and people's time in the Capitol as well. So ongoing conversations, I think, about anywhere that public business is being done to make sure that not only our members, but also people feel safe participating in their democracy.
Do you feel like Wisconsin lawmakers from both parties are able to communicate with each other in a less heated way than we sometimes see at the national level?
About this issue, I think we are. You know, I think we all see political violence as detrimental to our democracy. We see it impact people on both sides of the aisle, and we all feel that it's a real problem.
Turning to legislation now, you have a package of bills that you've called Kids First. What's the overall goal?
Sure. So we hear all of the time from people in every community across the state of Wisconsin about their desire to see their kids go to great schools and the fact that they are having a difficult time making ends meet. So the core piece of legislation in this package would increase general aids to schools and provide some inflationary increases. In the most recent state budget, Republicans did not fund general aids, which means that the impact will be felt in people's property taxes. So we put about $1.2 billion into this bill to make sure that people's property taxes do not continue to go up to fund their local public schools. We also have a Healthy School Meals for All bill that we put out earlier this year and have re-upped. This would save the average family in Wisconsin two kids about $1,800 a year on groceries. We know that groceries are a real concern for people in Wisconsin. So we're hoping that Republicans will consider that bill. And then the third is a voucher tax transparency bill. In communities like mine and in many across the state, we're seeing significant public money go to private schools, and people don't really realize that because it's not easy to find those numbers. So we want to make sure people understand where their public dollars are going.
The first two pieces of legislation you mentioned have significant price tags, the increase in general funding for schools, the free meals for students. They didn't end up in the state budget. Do you have any hope that in a Republican-led legislature, these things have a chance to see the light of day?
We haven't seen promising signs. I think our Republican colleagues are not really willing to tackle the core issues facing our students and our schools and would rather pass the buck off to local people. We've seen referendum after referendum across the state, and people are not happy that they are going to have to continue to increase their own property taxes in order to fund their schools, but they're caught between a rock and a hard place. I do hope that the GOP will see the error of their ways and recognize that it is not right to continue passing off school funding to local folks and to taxpayers. But We haven't seen promising signs yet.
Before we move on from education, another test taken by students in Wisconsin shows persistent racial disparities in test outcomes. We see similar stories like this all the time in Wisconsin for years now. What do you think the legislature could do to help close those gaps?
We know that one-on-one support of students and implementing the latest curriculum and methodologies is critically important to support every student to succeed. And so the most important thing the legislature can do is provide the resources that our districts need to provide that intensive support to students who are struggling, students of color, low-income students, those with special needs or English language learners. Our districts have been struggling for years and making cuts. We see Republicans proposing legislation to consolidate districts, meaning more time that kids are sitting on the bus, and other bills that really just do not address the core of the issue that our schools are facing.
We're talking to Assembly Minority Leader Greta Neubauer, Democrat from the Racine area. Representative Neubauer, there's been a disagreement over the balance of power in state government. This gets a little nuanced, but it's important stuff. Governor Evers saying Republicans are blocking his authority to create agency rules, leading to a delay in enforcing legislation that's already been passed. The state Supreme Court has weighed in on this. Speaker Voss gave us a different take from the governor last week. Here's a listen.
Well, for anybody who's listening that thinks it's wrong for a person to be a king, our Supreme Court has basically said that the executive, whoever it is, a Republican or a Democrat, has the right to impose rules on the state with no oversight from other elected officials. That's wrong.
So Representative Voss saying, hey, lawmakers should have some say, committees should have some say in how these rules are created and implemented. Your thought on this standoff?
We have seen Speaker Voss and the GOP majorities continue to grab power over the last several years. We saw this with the lame duck session after Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call were elected, and we're seeing it again here. The people of Wisconsin elected Governor Tony Evers twice to run this administration, and Republicans have continued to delay the implementation of rules by simply not taking them up. It would be one thing if they were taking them up, but they were just refusing to even hear these rules and allow them to see the light of day, get public comment, et cetera. So I think that it's good that the Supreme Court has reminded everyone about the balance of power here and said that the legislature cannot indefinitely hold on to this administrative rulemaking process.
There's an election coming up, of course. Everything is up for grabs. One hypothetical outcome could be you and your Democratic colleagues flip both chambers, but Republicans take the governor's office. Will you be singing a different tune then when a Republican governor has this authority and Democratic lawmakers can't thwart that?
I think it's always important to maintain the balance of power. And again, I do think that the legislature under GOP control has been continuing to attempt to take powers away from the governor and hold them in their own hands. And so I think it is good that we have a Supreme Court that is taking these issues seriously and looking at the balance of powers and making sure that we're allowing each branch of government to perform its function.
Speaking of elections, last week, some of your Republican and Democratic colleagues met at the Capitol to announce a slate of legislation related to elections. A couple of the pieces of legislation had bipartisan support. There were some Republican measures, some Democratic measures. Are there changes, are there priorities that you'd like to see when it comes to how we run elections in Wisconsin?
I'm hoping that there's some bipartisan work that we can do this session. An item that we've been thinking about working on for several years now is Monday ballot counting. So this would allow our local clerks to get started counting those ballots that have come in during the early vote period on Monday, so that we're more likely to have election results announced on election night. We all want to know what the results are before we go to bed on Tuesday night. And I think there is bipartisan understanding that that would be good for the people of Wisconsin and for our democracy. So we haven't seen the bills coming from the Republicans yet, but I do hope that there is an opportunity for us to address that issue to make sure that our democracy is able to function and people can trust the process.
One proposal that's been talked about has been the idea of Monday ballot processing, saying, hey, we're going to do all the steps to have this ballot ready to rock, but still count it, still process it, or finish it up on Tuesday. Would that be close enough to that Monday count idea for you?
We'd be happy to look at the details of that. I think anything that allows our clerks to get started a little sooner is something that we're interested in considering. But of course, it would all be in the details and making sure it's workable for them on election day.
Staying with elections now, we're just over a year out from next year's elections. You and your fellow Democrats, again, in the minority in both chambers of the legislature, what are the messages you are trying to send to voters to say, hey, it's time to flip, especially with the redrawn maps here in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. Well, we see the chaos coming out of Washington right now. And we see that our Republican legislators here in Wisconsin are not willing to lift a finger to address the real challenges that people are facing in our state and that the Trump administration is inflicting on Wisconsin. We know that people are really struggling with costs. That's cost of groceries and prescription drugs, housing and childcare. We have real proposals that will address these issues, that will help families in Wisconsin do more than just make ends meet. But our Republican colleagues are just really not willing to engage on those issues. We see tariffs wreaking havoc on Wisconsin. We see federal Republicans intent on cutting people's access to health care. This is not what we hear our constituents want. These are not the issues that they want us to be addressing. They are not interested in seeing the wealthiest people in this country continue to get tax break after tax break while they struggle. So I really hope that we're able to see a different path in the future in Wisconsin. Our members are always out speaking to their constituents, hearing about the issues that are impacting them, and then, of course, bringing those ideas to Madison and working to address them in the legislature.
Representative Neubauer, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Representative Greta Neubauer, State Assembly Minority Leader, a Democrat. She represents a Racine area district. You can listen back to our conversation with Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss from last Monday. You can find that at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, with food prices on the rise, in part due to White House tariffs, an independent grocery store owner in the Wisconsin Dells talks about how his business is changing.
I think people are trying to do whatever they can to stretch their food dollars.
How people's paychecks are not keeping up with grocery bills, that conversation is ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. At the grocery store checkout, you're almost certainly paying more than you did a year ago.
So I do most of the big grocery runs for our family, and now I divide the list between needs and wants. We need more flour to make pancakes. We're running low on vanilla extract, but vanilla falls into the want category. I'll check the price once I get to the aisle and make a decision based on the other needs in the cart.
The latest Consumer Price Index shows that grocery prices in the Midwest rose by 3% on average over the last year. In the category of fruits and vegetables, prices went up 2.4% in August.
What is the perspective of Wisconsin grocers in this economic climate? Jeff Maurer owns Maurer's Market in the Wisconsin Dells. Jeff, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kate. I'm glad to be here.
As we see grocery prices going up, how are your customers reacting to these changes?
Yeah, it's been a very volatile year, I would say, the last 12 months. They are reacting by buying a lot more private label than we ever have before because of the price difference between a private label and a name brand or national brand. They're definitely looking or shopping with our ad and looking for any kind of specials or deals that we may have. We also think that they are shopping multiple locations, whether it's big box or other independents maybe in the area. There are a couple of dollar stores. So I think people are trying to do whatever they can to stretch their food dollars.
So as you see more of this comparison shopping going on, how does that affect your store? What is the margin grocery stores like yours operate on when it comes to setting your prices and figuring out what can go on sale?
Well, when we put something on sale, we those items are getting discounted by the manufacturer. And then we pass on that discount, and then we drop our margin to the lowest possible point we can for our ad. On an everyday basis, we're maintaining the same gross profit margins that we've been doing for years. Unfortunately, though, the base cost goes up, so that means the retail also goes up as we keep the same margins. Now, one exception would be just in the last 2 weeks, I've lowered my margins on coffee because coffee has just gotten ridiculously high priced. And I decided to lower our margin in order to make it more affordable for the average customer.
So would you consider coffee to be your lost leader of sorts right now?
Definitely. Most definitely.
Are you able to sustain those low prices on coffee, for instance, though?
Not for an extended period of time. At some point, I will have to go back up again. I certainly hope, and probably I'm being naive, but I would like to think that the cost will come down at some point, and we can go back to more reasonable retail prices and go back to our normal gross profit.
Jeff, have you had to change how you do business, which wholesalers you buy from, or which products you carry to accommodate these prices?
Yes. The answer to your question is yes. We are not so much looking for different suppliers, but looking for different products within the various vendor community. We currently deal with about 150 different vendors in our store, and they all carry different products, and they're also changing. So we are looking for the best value. We're trying to downsize products whenever we can. We're getting away from the family, you know, the large multi-packs or larger size products, and trying to come in with some smaller packages, therefore having lower retails and making it more affordable.
We've seen this jump in meat, fish, poultry, and eggs, 5.6% year over year. What is happening in this category?
Not so much with poultry for us. Certainly beef has gone up, and beef is, again, just crazy how quickly it's going up and how often it's going up. We are literally checking every invoice every time we receive a shipment because the cost is changing that frequently. So it makes it extremely difficult, and we have to be very diligent in order to protect our margins. But again, the same thing, we've had to lower some of our margins in meat, especially the real important, I guess, or high volume meats like ground beef or ground chuck, some of the steaks. We've varied margin in order to make it most affordable for our customers. As far as you brought up eggs, mm-hmm. and I can't compare it. I don't recall what it was last year, but today I'm $2.89 on a dozen large white eggs. And that's a pretty reasonable price, I think.
Yes.
I
mean,
I think we probably all remember $5 and $6 a dozen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So I feel comfortable with it's getting down there where people can afford it, and it's obviously very nutritious and a nice protein for their customer, for their families.
What is the root cause here? What is driving up prices? Can you explain what's going on in the background?
Well, it really varies by category. As far as beef is concerned, there's a shortage of cattle in the U.S. The cattle ranchers have, over the past couple of years, reduced their herds for whatever reason, and I'm not sure why. But it once they try to rebuild it, it takes a couple of years for that cattle to grow to a point where it's able to be processed for customer use. So it's a long-term project on that. I think a lot of it has to do with feed cost, transportation costs of getting not only the feed to the animals, but the animals to a processing center. So that's one area. And that the other, frankly, is the tariffs. The tariffs are impacting us. And that's one reason why coffee prices have gone up so dramatically is the price of coffee beans coming out of Brazil or Colombia, mm-hmm. as well as then cocoa. And a lot of our chocolates have gone up. Our candy prices have really gone up recently in the last few weeks because of cocoa. And I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe most of that is coming out of South America. And so that is also being subject to the tariffs.
So get ready for a pricier Halloween.
Oh, certainly. Definitely pricier Halloween and unfortunately for Thanksgiving and Christmas.
With that, I want to turn our attention to SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We know that there are changes coming to work requirements, changes to exemptions. What percentage of your business would you say comes from food stamps, and what are you anticipating here?
Up until the last year, it's been about 10% of our business has been SNAP sales or SNAP-related. We are extremely lucky in Wisconsin. I understand the federal government has cut back on the benefits, and they've pushed more of those responsibilities or financial costs to the states, the individual states. And we're fortunate in Wisconsin that we have a very strong food share program. And they have this state has dedicated a lot of funds to help customers maintain the level of spending that they can with SNAP. So we've seen a slight decrease. Time will tell if it gets worse, depending upon the availability of funds from the federal government as well as from the state. So right now, it hasn't affected us a lot. I am concerned about the future and how it may impact us going forward.
In your partnership with local food pantries and as you sell to those pantries, what have you heard? Do you find that there are more people relying on pantries?
Oh, certainly. It is incredible. As I've been working with food pantries since I purchased the store 7 years ago, and to hear the change and the impact of today's environment for families and the affordability of groceries for families, there is a tremendous amount of need. And unfortunately, the food pantries do not have enough. They cannot supply enough product for the demand.
Jeff, I want to situate your store in the Wisconsin Dells, which is a tourism hub. Dells tourism hit an all-time high last year. How does tourism affect your business?
Significantly. It is. We are certainly reliant on the tourists during the summer months and hoping that they come to the Dells and not only enjoy everything we have to offer from a community standpoint, but also hopefully they're shopping with us while they're here in town versus maybe going to the big box stores or dollar stores. So we work hard to using social media, texting, digital ads, all those kinds of things to make our tourists, make them aware that we're here and we're ready to serve.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Kate. Thank you for having me.
That is Jeff Maurer, who owns Maurer's Market in the Wisconsin Dells. We've been talking about the economic pressures on grocery stores and rising prices for the things we put in our grocery cart. Now to SNAP benefits, also known as food share here in Wisconsin. SNAP helps nearly 700,000 people in our state put food on the table, and there are major changes coming to this program. Tim Smeeding studies poverty. He is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kate. Nice to be back.
Major changes are underway with the stricter federal rules for SNAP. How will federal changes affect hunger here in Wisconsin, do you think?
Oh, there's going to be a big effect. There's no doubt about it. They're tightening the rules. The state's going to have to undertake an awfully large amount of expense, which we can talk about, in order to enforce the rules so that they're not penalized by the USDA. There'll be a big tightening. There will be a number of people who are either thrown off or thrown into some sort of a work requirement and so forth. So my guess is that we'll probably end up with maybe 50,000 fewer Wisconsinites getting benefits now.
50,000 fewer without benefits. And you mentioned that there could be benefit losses that result from, you know, paperwork missteps or missed deadlines. Is that a risk with these new rules?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If they determine there's been more than a 6% error rate, okay, the states can force Wisconsin to pay as much as 15% of benefit costs, which have been funded 100% by the feds in the past. So in other words, if your error rate was over 6% and they were going to charge 15% of total benefits, that could cost the state $205 million that they'd have to pay in order to keep people eating and keep people on SNAP.
These changes are coming as we see grocery prices in the Midwest up 3% compared to last year. How is grocery inflation impacting what people buy, especially for low-income households?
Oh, it is. It's hard to say exactly, but I mean, many people are bartering now and so forth. But those prices are really hard. The prices are rising faster than incomes or wages. And they're probably going to rise faster because of tariffs and other sorts of shortages. So olive oil, for instance, unless it's from the United States, it's imported. It's going to cost you more. Lots of other things, too. Depends on how much is passed through by the provider, by the grocer. But it's not pretty.
What is that relationship between food stamp benefits and grocery stores? Can you talk about that?
Sure. Grocery stores, or SNAP, is a wonderful what we call local multiplier, okay? Because if you have SNAP, you spend more on food, and that creates more food-related jobs in the food industry, and those people spend money, too, locally, and so forth. So there's a local multiplier. So if you reverse engineer that, something like 55,000 jobs in Wisconsin probably are related to SNAP benefits. And if you cut SNAP by 20-25%, you're going to lose 15,000 jobs. And you're going to lose them in rural areas where in particular that'll lead stores to close.
And so as you watch this ripple effect with SNAP benefits and work requirement changes that started this month, they will be expanding in November. What are you watching for?
Wisconsin's going to have to be very, diligent, or they're going to lose money, as you saw before, if they don't do a really good job administering benefits the way that the feds want it to be. We're going to have to spend money to increase food stamps, employment, and training because more adults will need to meet the work requirement to stay on the benefit. We're going to have to hire additional quality control staff at the state and county level to review cases to make sure that we keep our error rate under 6%. And we're going to have to pay $43.5 million per year just to make up for the reduction in the federal share of costs to administer the program, which is effective October 1st. And these will grow over time. So this is, it's hard. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on food banks, which there already is a lot of pressure. Now, this isn't the only thing that's going to push it. I'll give you an example. Medicare and Medicaid folks, CMMS, have $50 billion in rural medical relief that they can distribute. Half of it's on a per-state basis, but the other half is at the discretion of the administration of Mehmet Oz, who's running CMMS. And it turns out that he has stated that if you don't implement policies pushed by the Trump administrations, such as waivers barring low-income people from using food stamps to purchase non-nutritious foods, if you have mandates for schools to reestablish, don't have mandates for schools to reestablish the presidential fitness test, and a requirement that doctors take continuing education classes on nutrition, you won't get some of this money. So he's got, there's a big stick in terms of Medicaid money that's tied to how well we do with SNAP.
Well, I appreciate your time on this. Thank you so much, Tim.
You're welcome. Take care, Kate.
Tim Smeeding studies poverty and economic mobility. He's Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We also heard from Wisconsin Dells grocery store owner Jeff Maurer about how volatile food prices and changes to SNAP benefits are affecting grocers.
Still ahead, a new memoir from a Mount Horeb native goes inside the world of competitive figure skating and how brother and sister pairs skaters coped with their mother's dementia.
Once it was time to give back to our mother what she had given to us over all those years, I feel so grateful that I had my brother to share that load with.
The book is called Motion Dazzle. That's coming up next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Growing up in the 1980s in Mount Horeb, Jocelyn Jane Cox and her older brother Brad started on their journey to become competitive pairs figure skaters.
Their spark was sitting around the TV glued to the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, New York.
The skaters leaped and spun in perfect unison, and Kitty and Peter Carruthers, they flew across the ice. Jocelyn remembers that moment well.
It did not go unnoticed by us that they were brother and sister. The next day, our mother consulted her trusty Yellow Pages and found out there were group lessons at an indoor rink called the Madison Ice Arena, about 20 minutes away.
6 years after that, her mother moved Jocelyn and Brad across the country to Delaware to train with an elite figure skating coach.
Jocelyn's new memoir draws on the strength and determination to wow audiences, and later in life it captures more difficult moments of Jocelyn caring for her mother, who suffered from dementia, but also becoming a new mother herself. The book is called Motion Dazzle, a memoir of motherhood loss and skating on thin ice. Jocelyn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This is a real honor to be on the program.
You skated competitively with your brother Brad for 11 years. What are your earliest memories lacing up your figure skates in Mount Horeb?
Good question. I first laced up my skates on my own driveway. My father froze it over with the garden hose. It was probably already icy, but he helped it along with the garden hose and the low temperatures in that time, pre-global warming, made a little, probably very bumpy, but excellent ice rink to just get started. From there, there was a little rink that was created by the town, and they froze over, I believe, what was a little league field on Garfield Avenue. It had a little warming hut, and it was this beautiful little rink in the middle of town outside. And that's really where we got started and skated for years before it became more formalized for us.
You call him a full throttle brother. You know, he just takes it all head on. Did he bring you along with that? Did he help to make you braver? Because these jumps and these falls could, you know, do a lot of damage to the body.
Yeah. My brother came out of the womb with determination, I think. He brings a determination to everything that he does. This was not my personality type, yet I really admired him, and I wanted to be more like him. He was 5 years older, which when we're younger is quite an age span. You know, when you're 8 and 13, he's kind of in this whole other level of maturity and development. And so he was able to pick up a lot of the skating elements quicker than I was. And I don't know that I ever became quite brave enough for the activity of pair skating. And the miracle is that I kept going and that I did actually do what I did, because I was in a constant state of fear pretty much the entire time. What I preferred more was the performing side of things, not the getting tossed up in the air like salad or pizza dough.
Can you talk about your mom in this role of taking you all over Wisconsin and, you know, to other parts of the country for these competitions? And then in your first really big competition, you two do really well, and yet you get dead last. And she's kind of like, suck it up. Life isn't fair. What was she like as a mom or as a skating mom?
Yeah, it's interesting you use the term skating mom, because I actually would not describe her in that way. She was more of a quiet manager, and she was sort of behind the scenes making it all happen. And, you know, I've grappled with this for many years, but I think my mom was in a tough spot because one of her children absolutely loved it. And one of her children was 50-50 on it. I would say I was a 50-50 split of loving it and hating it. Hmm. And one of her, her one child needed the other in order to complete his dream. And I was sort of, I admired him enough that I did want to keep going. So I think she was in a tough spot. She also wanted her children to have positive activities in their lives. Before skating, she signed us up for all kinds of activities, you know, whether it was tap dancing in Verona or computer classes. I don't even remember where those were, French classes in Madison. So she was someone who was going to keep her children occupied in what she considered to be a healthy way. Later in life, I asked her, how could you let me do this sport when you saw how often it hurt me? And by hurting me, I think I meant both physically and psychologically. And I don't think she knew she was quoting Nietzsche when she said, kind of jokingly and kind of seriously, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. Mm. And I actually think this is something she did believe to her core. And I also think it probably was pretty hard for her to see me getting hurt so often and see my brother trying to hold me up in the air and not always successfully.
Hmm. And everything changes in the family dynamic when at age 12 and year 12, Brad 17, your parents get divorced. And it strikes me that your dad has been hustling so much in the background, you know, running a chiropractic clinic in Mount Horeb and having the hotel. How did the divorce affect you and affect your feelings about figure skating?
It affected me so much, mostly because it was a surprise. My parents did not fight that I saw. They did not fight in front of us. And I was absolutely shocked and surprised when my father told us that they would be getting divorced. And I, of course, like many children of divorce, assumed it was my fault or our fault because of the skating. When we, at age 14, moved away from Mount Horeb to Delaware in order to train with an elite Olympic coach, I think it was really two-pronged. It was, yes, to get elite training and to be around other pair skaters and ice dancers, but it was also, I think, a nice clean break for my mom to get a new start away from a small town and away from a place where my father did have those businesses and more people knew him. But I think in the end, it was a wonderful thing that she got away from there and for herself.
We're talking with Jocelyn Jane Cox, a former competitive pairs figure skater and a native of Mount Horeb. Her new memoir is called Motion Dazzle. As the memoir goes on, we learn your mother is diagnosed with dementia when she is 75. You have a baby. You are trying to help your mom navigate mental decline, and you're also trying to care for this infant. How did you decide to... how did you decide to include this aspect of your life in the memoir and how to write about your mom's ailments in this way?
Yes, actually, my mother was diagnosed with dementia before I was pregnant. Mm. And so I actually went through my pregnancy caring for her through the beginning stages of her decline, which ended up being quite precipitous. So it was through my pregnancy, it was through the moments of childbirth, it was through having a newborn. And I knew, so the plot of my story is that I follow, for the most part, the day of my son's first birthday party. And it was a DIY event or affair, and it was zebra themed. And on that day, my mother was in the hospital, but she had been in the hospital many, many times. And it had gotten to the point where we actually couldn't drop everything and go down and drive the 3 hours down from New York to Delaware to be with her. But by the end of that night, and this is not really a spoiler because it's, you know, sort of baked into the book, but she did pass away that same night. I sat there and I said, this day will always include joy and pain for me. It will always be his birthday and it will always be the day of her death. So I knew on some level, having been a writer for a very long time, I didn't know I was going to write a book that night, but I saw how the zebra really embodied those opposite emotions and those opposite states of mind. And not to mention that these people were experiencing opposite trajectories in that he was in a state of ascension and she was in a state of decline for the entire year before that. So there's a lot of playing with the concept of opposition in the narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Zebras, stripes, confusing predators with their motion dazzle, and you carry that that thread through the book. And I really marvel how in caregiving you and Brad are able to divide up the duties. And the two of you have your specialties, it seems, and you really tag team on care in a way. And I wonder if that specializing at all was learned from your bonds of figure skating together.
I 100% believe that my brother and I have been a team for a very long time, and it has taken different permutations. So not only were we a team on the ice, but for many years we were coaching. We were a coaching team. And finally, yes, once it was time to give back to our mother what she had given to us over all those years, I feel so grateful that I had my brother to share that load with and he could bring his sort of analytical abilities to the table to take over her finances while I was perhaps a little more in charge of her medical care. But it was a tag team, and I just couldn't have been more appreciative of that help. And I didn't just have my brother. I had many close friends, and I had the help of my extremely supportive and loving husband, who also really adored my mother. And they had a beautiful relationship that was very genuine and full of love. The reality is that you cannot be all things to all people. And I think we all intellectually know that. But I think for me, for example, hosting that birthday party, even though I was going through a very dark time, while it was more labor or more work, it was something that brought me a lot of joy. And I wanted to have that fun DIY party because that fed me as a person. And my mother was an entertainer in that way. My mother was a tablescaper. My mother enjoyed putting on cute parties with themes. And I felt in a way that I was continuing her tradition, but also saying, today I need to be a mother. I'm not going to be a daughter today. And I actually can't do both. And has that given me some regret? Of course it has, because I was not there for my mother's death. But I think also people in the sandwich generation need to provide some forgiveness for themselves and go easy on themselves because it is extremely difficult.
As we close, you've been writing now for years about your skating adventures. And at one point in the memoir, you say it's kind of like a form of therapy. How does writing feed you as a person?
There's something about memoir where you are sifting through your memories and you're not just recounting them in a matter-of-fact, straightforward way. You are attempting, when you write memoir, to extract the meaning from these events that may be very complicated. And it's not that you alight on some kind of answer, but you are able through the writing process very often to find some peace with what happened. And I think that that process of writing this book, especially that first draft, and then the many iterations since, allowed me to think about my mother's life and allowed me to connect with the person she was before she got dementia. Because when we lose someone and they have memory loss at the end of their lives, it gets very messy and very sad. And they may not at all be acting the way that they were. My mother actually was opposite from how she was. So the act of writing this memoir gave me the opportunity to connect with my mom and who she had been my whole life, rather than focusing on those final and very difficult 2 years.
Jocelyn, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for the book.
Thank you so much for reading it and for having me on today.
Jocelyn Jane Cox is a former competitive figure skater and coach. Her book is called Motion Dazzle, a memoir of motherhood loss and skating on thin ice. She has upcoming book signings set for November in Madison and in her hometown of Mount Horeb.
A while back, I talked about mispronouncing Wisconsin place names. This weekend, a lot of you responded to a new social media video we put up on that topic.
Rob asked for commonly mispronounced Wisconsin place names. Here are some of the answers.
Jana writes them. Is it Waukesha or Waukesha? Neither.
Suzanne says, one that always made my dad laugh and roll his eyes at the same time was the newscaster that always mispronounced Nasita.
Lisa is from Manitowoc and says that name gets mispronounced all the time.
Katie remembers Portage being pronounced as Portage in TV commercials back in the 60s and 70s. So glitzy.
Fancy. John says, for those in the know, it isn't Muscoda, it's Muscaday. For those of a certain generation, Iowa County is pronounced Iway.
And Althea says, I used to crack up laughing every time, the weather radio said Antigo and Shawano instead of Antigo and Shano.
Keep sharing your mispronounced Wisconsin place names. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today producers include Joe Tarr, Royce Podeswa, and Avery Lee Rogers.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.